Bristol was Peter Everett. Mary Stott, the great campaigning journalist and the first editor of The Guardian's Women's Page, is the choice of Catherine Whitehorn for this week's Great Lives. That's in a moment. Then at 5 o'clock, it's PM with Eddie Mair, who joins me now with the details. Eddie.
Hello, Corrie. The UK economy shrank in the last 3 months of 2010 by 0.5%, a figure which has caused a degree of shock. Stephanie Flanders will explain what it means. Richard Galpin in Moscow will report on the aftermath of the airport bombing. Sky Sports football pundit Andy Gray has been sacked in the last few minutes following his comments about assistant referee Sian Massey. A former Conservative peer, Lord Taylor, has been found guilty of making thousands of pounds in false parliamentary expenses claims. We'll have more on all of that, plus the Academy Award nominations at five.
Thanks very much, Eddie. Well, now on BBC Radio 4, here's Matthew Paris.
Hello and welcome to Great Lives. My guest today is the veteran journalist Catherine Whitehorn, and she's chosen another great woman of the newspaper world, Mary Stott. Here's Mary describing the moment when in 1926, at the precocious age of 19, she was made women's editor of the Leicester Mail, a great triumph for a woman at that time, you'd think, but Mary put her head in her hands and wept.
I didn't want to be a woman journalist. I wanted to be a journalist. I didn't want to do a women's page. I wanted to write anything, to report anything, to sob anything. I wanted to be a journalist. Men don't have men's pages. They aren't confined to a man's page or to sport or anything. I wanted to be on the same terms as men. That's why.
Mary Stott talking on Desert Island Discs in 1994. The idea of the women's page is a conundrum we'll be returning to. But first, let me introduce Catherine Whitehorn more fully. Catherine was a star columnist on The Observer for more than 30 years, after writing articles for women's magazines, Picture Post, The Spectator, and the classic Cooking in a Bedsitter. I've been looking at her autobiography, Selective Memory, takes her from childhood in Mill Hill through six schools, two universities, a stint running a club in Finland, another waiting on tables in America, to her 45-year-old marriage to thriller writer Gavin Lyle, the birth and progress of her two sons, her endless public service work on boards and committees, her brilliant How to Survive series of books, and the ups and downs of Fleet Street. She still writes and broadcasts regularly and is agony aunt for Saga magazine. Catherine, why have you chosen Mary Stott as your great life?
More or less for the effect she's had on women's journalism generally. I didn't know her terribly well as a person, but she really changed the entire way that women's journalism was regarded. And I should think if anybody could be called the mother of the feminisation of Fleet Street, Mary is more responsible than anybody else.
Can you remember when she first impinged on you, when you first noticed her?
Well, she actually impinged on me, if you see what I mean, indirectly, because she had changed the women's pages of The Guardian, we'll come back to that, and her disciple, George Seddon, came from The Guardian to The Observer. Mary Stott's influence on me was originally simply through George, who thought that the kind of things that we worry about were just as important and needed to be written about as honestly and as rigorously and as well as anything else. And get away from the whole concept of women's page being a sort of box in the middle of serious stuff. If you can remember what newspapers were like, say, in 1950, they were only things that were of interest to busy men, which was business and hard news and politics and sport and stock exchange and so forth.
And war.
Oh, and war, of course, yes. If there, well, there usually was one. And I think if you had to point to one person who got it changed, then Mary's the one.
With us to share her own memories of Mary, we also have Dame Liz Forgan, writer, broadcaster, television editor, managing director, BBC Radio, part of cultural and public life for as long as I've been around, who's immortalised alongside Mary Stott in a painting that hangs in the National Portrait Gallery. Tell us about that.
They commissioned a marvellous young painter, Sarah Raphael, to paint a picture of the women of the Guardian women's page on the grounds that we were a sort of collective cultural phenomenon. The dramatist persona were Polly Toynbee, Jill Tweedy, Posy Simmons, Mary Stott and me.
Did either of you know Mary personally? Let me start with you, Catherine.
Well, I knew her a bit because just after she'd retired from The Guardian, we were having one of our not infrequent gaps between women's editors, and I said, why don't you ask Mary Stott to come and look after us for 6 months? And she came, and we had a great time. And she said, at the end of it, she said, it was so nice working with just women, none of all this bitchy backbiting that you get with men. So I got to know her then. But it was the sort of pages that she wrote and the sort of things that she thought ought to be on them. Everything that women were interested in, which included education. Okay, men get educated too, but women are very interested in medical things and particularly human relations. And actually, it was quite funny because all human relations cropped up on the women's page, not anywhere else, including male homosexuality.
And yes, which men, for some reason, couldn't talk about in those
well,
days.
Well, apparently not. Anyway, there wasn't a man's page that covered anything like that.
No. And you, Liz, you actually knew her as well as...
Well, I met her when I became the woman's editor of The Guardian, and there she was, a columnist. Can you imagine? Mary Stott, the great, famous editor. She's a columnist. And the first time I met her, it's very interesting to hear that clip you played just now, because she came up to me, put her arms around me, and she said, I know what it's like. So I said, yes, Mary, I know you know what it's like. I'm very honoured to be your successor. No, she said, I mean, I know what it's like to be a serious political journalist and be told that you've got to be the editor of the Woman's Page. But she said, don't worry, it'll be marvellous. And she was right.
Was she fun as a person?
She had a great chuckle. Yes, she was fun. She was fun. Mm. Not
in
a kind of...
a little hesitation
well,
there.
Well, because she was also a very serious person.
Yes.
I mean, she wasn't a larky person at all. But she enjoyed life and in a rather simple kind of way. And she laughed and smiled about things. But she was not a satirical person or a very smart-alecky person at all. She was very straightforward, but great fun.
Interested in that remark about her being straightforward. If we go back a bit to where she was born... Mary Waddington in Leicester in 1907. She described her parents as journalists and said that she was going to end up as a journalist too because her parents had been journalists. Was this sort of simple directness characteristic of the
yes,
woman?
She thought of herself as a very ordinary person, and she was. She looked ordinary, she lived ordinary, she identified, was interested in ordinary people, which was actually her great secret.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about Mary is that 20 years... before anyone thought of the internet and things changing the relationship between journalists and their readers, Mary had essentially invented Web 2.0 in the sense that she made the page out of the lives of her listeners. People wrote letters to the Woman's Page, and instead of just publishing them as a letter and then going back to being a professional journalist, she thought, this is interesting, this is the stuff of life. And so she invited the readers in, and there was mutualisation on the Woman's Page of The Guardian before anyone had ever heard of computers.
Yes. And as Liz said, she absolutely was a journalist from the start. She said, with her dolls, she used to say, she'd tell her dolls, I must go now, I have to write my copy, you know, when she was about five.
Her mother wrote two women's columns for two Leicester papers. A liberal, very liberal family.
She came from a professional, serious, liberal family who clearly believed that girl daughters should be treated in a serious fashion, and she made the most of that.
She did come from a different generation. Her youth was an exciting time for women. In 1928, women first got the vote on the same terms as men, which she vividly remembered when she went to vote for the first time in the election of 1929.
I got up very early in the morning, because I thought, well, if I get to the polling station just after it opens, maybe I'll be the very first woman to vote at the age of 21. So I dressed myself up in a scarlet jumper because I was voting Labour. And I went off to the polling station, proud as punch. It was a wonderful day. Never forget it.
It's extraordinary that we three are talking about a woman whom you both knew, who was there and around and already a grown-up before women could vote. It just seems another age. Well, it was another age, but not so long ago.
But somehow she didn't seem like a very old woman. She was just like, you know, a generation of what we were then, 35, 40-year-olds.
And also, I think this business of saying she didn't seem old is because we have a stereotype, don't start me, about what people who are old are like. And that was another breakthrough, in a sense, that Mary never saw any reason to stop doing what she was doing merely because she was getting older and older. And I do remember, one of her aged birthdays, I can't remember which one, and everybody said, what on earth are we going to give Mary? And she lived at that point out in Greenwich. And the only thing they could think of that would really please her and help her was put an enormous amount of money into a taxi account so that she could come whizzing in and out to meetings and meeting her friends and so on. So I think you could say that she was moving the whole idea of what women are like, which is women do X and women do Y, and of course they never do, you know, that fearful Z. And she just changed a good deal of the perceptions of this.
The worst manifestation of age for Mary was that her voice, she was a singer, she loved singing, and her singing voice gradually got deeper and deeper. She ended up singing bass, I think, in her choir.
Yes.
She, right from the start, started lobbying on issues such as custody of children, right of women to sue for divorce, the right to work after marriage. Another thing we tend to forget, school teachers, when they got married, had to give up the job.
It wasn't just school teachers. The post office union was the last to let it go.
She was a very focused and practical sort of politician with a small P. She didn't waste an awful lot of time, as the rest of us did, arguing about the kind of aesthetics of feminism. Mary was very focused on people's lives, women's lives, and the obstacles to them living lives the way they wanted to live them. And, you know, with her readers and the power of the paper, she organised to get things changed. All kinds of organisations sprang up, which actually made a difference, got women together, and they campaigned and they changed rules and laws and customs that got in the way of their lives.
Interested in what Liz says about her being an intensely practical person. She'd started on a Bolton newspaper. She'd moved to Manchester, editing women's and children's publications for the Women's Cooperative Press. Then she became fascinated by the nuts and bolts of journalism, of sub-editing. Then she'd had this big break, the Manchester Guardian, and got really quite high up.
She was deputy sub-editor. And she was so good that she had she'd written a pamphlet which was necessary reading for every new person coming on the sub-editor's desk. And in spite of having been the person who wrote the pamphlet, they said, I'm sorry, we have to substitute somebody who can be the next chief sub-editor, who, of course, has to be a man. And that's the kind of thing that puts dynamite behind your attitudes, I
absolutely
think.
But because they said that the person beneath the chief sub-editor can't be a woman, otherwise the succession would go to a woman, and that can't happen. Other lesser people would have been inhabited by a sense of monstrous injustice for the rest of their life.
I don't think she wasted time with monstrous. She saw the injustice and she thought this something must be done. But I have reason to rue her talents as a sub-editor, because I always suspected when she delivered her copy it was always single-spaced typed, single space, which meant there was absolutely no room for me to insert words or change things. She knew perfectly well how to keep an editor's fidgety fingers off her copy.
In 1937, she married Kenneth, who apparently was always referred to as Kay, Kenneth Stott, a journalist with whom she had a daughter, Catherine Stott's, a familiar name now in journalism. And it was apparently a very, very happy marriage.
I think extremely happy. And one of the things that I admire about her so very much, though she was obviously extremely feminist, she didn't reject nearly as much of the ordinary lives of people who are not feminists as a lot of them did. For example, when you got the kind of understandable fury among some feminists about what men were up to, she would remember that she had always been incredibly encouraged by her father, by her husband.
She was not at all a radical feminist in any sense of the word. And when I was editing The Page in the 70s, the women's movement had many people in it who were deeply male-hating. And Mary was rather sort of motherly towards them. She kind of patted them on the head and sort of understood. But it was not her way of thinking at all.
Of course,
she really liked being a wife and mother and thought that women, on the whole, liked being wives and mothers. But they also wanted to be independent.
I think the fact that she had always been urged to be herself by her father and by her husband, you could see that there must have been moments when she was getting the wrong end of the stick at the office. People, I mean, everybody in newspaper office gets a hard time from time to time. And the fact that she got that sort of support at home was one of the things that she knew she valued.
Did you get a hard time?
Well, actually, it was Mary's disciple, George Seddon, who, so to speak, invented me and invented Shirley Conran and Bartie Phillips and quite a lot of other people, who was doing the same sort of job that Mary was doing. So, you know, in a sense, her influence spread out.
That's very generous of you. Catherine said she didn't have any difficulty because Mary invented the role. But actually, anybody who's enlarging the idea of a woman journalist or a male journalist gets bruised in the process. And I bet Catherine did too, even if she won't admit it.
I bet she did. She absolutely takes her place beside Mary in a quite small number of absolutely marvellous women who persuaded by the quality of their writing, not by their campaigning, by being absolutely marvellous at it. And I was the beneficiary of all that because I came along in the 70s, by which time, if you were halfway intelligent and a young woman, you got endless opportunities given to you because everyone's so thrilled that they could have a newsroom that wasn't entirely full of men. So, you know, I owe Mary and Catherine a very great deal.
Well, I didn't have to fight anybody. I didn't have to do any office struggles, really. And in a sense, the atmosphere was such that by the time it was me, I was getting to do things, not just in spite of being a woman, but because I was a woman, and they suddenly thought, oh, God, it's time we had one. You know.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, the writer Catherine Whitehorn, has chosen the groundbreaking 20th century women's journalist Mary Stott. Our expert is Stott's former colleague, Dame Liz Forgan. Apparently, Mary always considered herself terribly plain and talked frankly about it throughout her life.
The trouble was that then straight hair was very unfashionable, and my mother used to put my hair into curling rags every night, and about it, when she'd taken it out in the morning, it fell straight in about 10 minutes. And both my brothers had beautiful curly hair, and the younger of my two brothers, who are both older than me, he was very beautiful, there's no doubt. And so compared with him, I was plain, and I always thought of myself as plain. And in a way, I think it's quite an advantage.
Why?
Well, you have to earn being liked. You don't get being liked just because you're pretty.
Apparently, Mary never cared how she looked. Do you think that's true, or just she said she never cared how she looked?
How do I put this graciously? You might suppose that she wasn't particularly concerned with it. when you looked at her.
I mean, Catherine, I think you're being very unfair. But no, I think she took a great deal of trouble about her appearance, but only to be neat and proper. She was not a pretty woman, and she knew it, and it didn't keep her awake at night at all. But it's not that she just threw on any old clothes. She used to think quite carefully, and she would tell me, I do like this, I've got this, my new cardigan. I'd look at it and think to myself, it looks just like the old one. But she'd thought about it very carefully.
Yes. I think she perhaps had an attitude which I recognise from people in my family, which is that there was a sort of idea that serious women didn't fuss too much about clothes and appearance and so on. They were, as you say, neat and, you know, decently covered and so on. But I think she would have very much disliked the emphasis on, first of all, on appearance and clothes and sex. And I hate to think what Mary would have thought of the sort of emphasis on silly celebrities that in the papers nowadays. She wanted people who had done things, or she wanted ordinary women whose voices didn't get heard and she could make them heard.
I'd like to look a little more closely at her work for the Manchester Guardian, as it then was. This is around 1957. She said that editing the woman's page was the one page worth doing in the world for a feminist.
Well, she certainly did it better than anybody before that could have guessed.
But I'm quite surprised that Mary ended that quote by saying it's the best page to work on for a feminist, because actually I think what she thought was it was the best page to work on, and I came to think exactly the same many years later, because it was the only place where it was permitted to open doors into areas of human life which are absolutely rivetingly fascinating. And the woman's page desk was in the middle of the features floor of the Guardian when I worked there, and we would be sitting there talking about something or other, and I would notice chaps loitering
absolutely,
by, perched on the edge, just listening. What are they talking about? Edible complexes? My goodness, that's interesting. They would have died rather than write that themselves in the paper.
Mm.
But it was the place where not only areas of human life which are of absorbing interest to everybody were being discussed, but of course, at that moment, feminism was quite the most interesting political phenomenon in Britain. It was the place where political activity was happening. And so that made everybody very interested in it too. But Mary's words, that it's the most interesting page in the paper, I think was because she saw it as an open channel into the heart of human beings and human behaviour in a way that the rest of newspapers weren't.
Yes, including men. I wonder whether...
Absolutely.
..whether she entirely understood that editing a woman's page gave her the opportunity to enlarge the scope of newspaper writing to a kind of writing that men wanted to read, but they didn't quite think that they wanted other men to write it for them, and so they would read it in a woman's page. It's the human heart rather than just the woman's heart that
well,
I think...
Exactly, but I think Felicity Green's phrase, she was assistant editor of the Daily Mirror, the feminisation of Fleet Street, because it goes in two directions. First of all, that there's far more written by everybody, including men, of the personal side of life and the kind of things that women have always had to worry about. But also, and I suppose this is quite a long way from Mary Stott, but I think she was very much a starting gun for all this, that you now have women columnists on serious subjects not writing the same way they would as if they were men. It's all over the paper now that a women's viewpoint is of general interest and not just for the women's page.
And she got a fantastic stable of writers writing for her. Names like Jill Tweedy, Polly Toynbee, Shirley Williams, Margarita Lasky, Margaret Drabble, Lena Jager, Naomi Mitchison. It was absolutely...
It's amazing how much talent there is when you start looking for it.
Yes.
Good gracious me.
Somebody said about her, her successor, in fact, at The Guardian, fury is her fuel. Yet she seems to me a rather nice, gentle sort of soul, and one of the obituaries said the tone was more detergent than caustic. Which would you say? Is it detergent, caustic, fury?
I wouldn't have chosen any of them. I mean, she had a depth of indignation about injustice, that is true. But fury, it says to me somebody red in the face and shouting. Mary never did that, ever. I mean, a lot of feminists did do that at the time when I knew her, and she was never among those voices. She was deeply outraged by things that she saw as injustice, but she would never have demonstrated. Well, that's true, she would have demonstrated in the streets, but she would never shouted or been strident, the word that people always use about women. You never would have used about Mary at all. It's coming back to me now. I had a talk with her once about this very thing, because I always felt slightly guilty at being not a shrieker and not a joiner of great mass movements. And I talked about this with Mary, and she said, you and I are the same that way, she said. We would not move forward without those people. You know, we must never deny them. But you and I are never going to go burning things in the street or yelling. But they are necessary to carry the argument forward.
She was dead set against the idea of quotas of any kind, and quite iffy even about the idea of women's pages, although she...
Yes, she was. But we were all iffy about women's pages. I can remember writing a piece about... every now and again, we always had to write a piece about, why is there a woman's page? And to this day, I can't remember whether I argued for one or against one, but, I mean, the arguments were so well rehearsed. Mary was absolutely against favouritism, and which she regarded as patronising. She's very characteristic of a certain strand of campaigning women in that. She had got herself to where she got by her talent against fearful odds, and she would bitterly resent any notion that you should show favouritism towards women because poor little things, they'd been so badly treated. It was absolutely not in her lexicon. I used to think that when you finally won the argument, people would see that it was sensible and we'd never have to do it again. I worked for Channel 4 in its first 10 years, and Channel 4 was begun and run as a sensible place where women had serious roles up and down the organisation. And I thought then, when people come here, they can immediately sniff in the air that there's something different, and they'll say, oh, this is normal life, I see, that's how you do it, and we'd never have to argue it again. three or four people left the channel and it changed almost overnight. And we were back in exactly the same old chap sitting around the boardroom.
So never say the battle is...
In the story, not only of women, but of journalism, in a way that actually has not been possible in the immediate aftermath of her working life.
To Catherine Whitehorn, who chose The Great Life of Mary Stott, and to Mary's former colleague, Dame Liz Forgan, my thanks. Goodbye.